Hello. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And we are all very privileged because my guest is Dr. Jules Black. He's now retired, but he's a renowned OBGYN, internationally renowned, and he lives in Australia, but he's here in the United States. So I captured him. Hello, Dr. Jules Black.
Hello, Diana, Dr. Diana.
It's so good to have you, and you have written a very thoughtful, provocative book called Body Talk. It's published in Australia, and unfortunately, it's not available in the United States, but I still have my copy, and Jules and I first met in 1991. That's a long time ago, Jules.
The way you worded it certainly sounds that way.
At the World Association for Sexology. This was in Amsterdam. And he was, at that time, I think, a co-secretary.
So something I always had some sort of office in that organization.
Yes. And you contributed a lot. For one thing, what I remember, I have this memory of going to a sex show, because that's what they do in Amsterdam. They have live sex shows. And a bunch of us, I think you might have been in the mix, we were invited on stage, not to do anything sexual, but just to be participants, and we did a conga dance, and then this little dancer had nothing on underneath her little skirt, but she had a banana, and I refused to take part in biting that banana, and this very giant gorilla kind of encouraged me to do it, and I didn't. So then he showed up. I don't know if you remember this, Jules, but he showed up.
I've never forgotten it.
Okay, so he showed up in his human form. He had a gorilla costume on, a very tall black man, and he asked where the blonde and the little black dress was, and you covered for me. You said, oh, well, she's presenting a paper. But he was interested in me because I didn't want to participate in the ways that some of my colleagues did, i.e. taking a bite of the banana. I mean, I participated with the dancing. So you protected me, and that was something that I took very seriously, Jules. Thank you.
Well, that's nice. I have to confess that we were all on stage, and that was the biggest banana or longest banana I'd ever seen. And as she sort of was in a limbo kind of position on stage and
yes,
inserted
she was.
It, and we were invited to eat the banana, I decided I was going to be first because at that moment the banana was the furthest possible distance from her, the rest of her body. And as I bent over to bite the tip of the banana, who should walk in? But all the committee and all the echelons of the World Association, and they pointed at me and said, "Look, that's our Secretary General Treasurer."
Right, and there you are taking a bite of the banana from this woman's vulva sticking up.
Yes, but I was going to be the first. I wasn't going to be the last.
Yes, and that's why I was one of the last, and I just. You know, I'm pretty open. You know me, I'm pretty open, but I didn't
Absolutely.
Know where that banana had been. So,
but you see, if we as sexologists
mm-hmm.
can't participate in something like that,
mm-hmm.
if we are too rigid and too uptight, how can we possibly manage problems within our clients, you see.
Exactly.
We have to put our money where our mouth is.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that
to be open is really important.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean that we participate in orgies or sexually active with our clients. That's some people do that, but not the ethical sexologists.
Well, you as a medical doctor can't do that, and I can't do that either.
Yeah, but if we can't have fun and enjoy ourselves, then there's something wrong.
Exactly. I always say, and I might have gotten some of this philosophy from you, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right.
Well, that's I didn't coin that, but I would subscribe to that.
Yes, I know. So, in your book, which unfortunately is not available to our listeners, although they're worldwide, but it was first published in 1988, but Body Talk, an A to Z Guide to Women's Health, in the foreword, one of your admirers, Bettina, wrote, "What shone through was his genuine respect and concern for women, his belief in their right to seek information and to participate in decisions about their health." Here was a doctor, I'm skipping a little bit, who not only talks to women, but listens to them and learns from them. Wow. And then we already mentioned about your... the World Association for Sexology, but you're also the past president of the Australian Society for Sex Educators, Researchers,
yes,
and Therapists.
I was one of the co-founders, actually. And
really, the co-founder?
Somewhere down the line, I was also president for a couple of years. And that society is still going and is one of the member organizations of the World Association. So we have sex down under, you might say.
Yes, there's a joke about that, and we know you're the best at jokes. What is the joke about that?
Well, there is one which I think escapes me at the moment. I think, there's Greek sex and French love and this, that, and the other. And I think Australian love is just, down under.
Yeah, exactly. Australian love is down under.
Yes.
So then you write in your introduction to your book, Body Talk, the modern doctor and specialist must acquire the art of tempering his, her knowledge with listening and observing. Some say it is arrogance to have men laying down the law to women. For years, I have found that one of the best, quickest, and most powerful ways to educate the doctor is through the patient. But you are rare. Your attitude is rare.
I'm told that. It's something that's intuitive, I think. I don't think it's something that can be taught. You can teach all the theory and practice and so on, but there are certain things that are innate within a person. You've got it or you haven't.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've known you all these years and we're friends, and I'm so admiring of your high IQ, but also the EQ, the emotional intelligence, which, of course, has to do with lots and lots of intuition.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, that's not that I'm not incapable of dumb things, but not with my patients.
Yeah, and and I know that after you officially retired, you did a lot of volunteer work in Australia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I do some, but it's interesting, you can offer your services, but the younger generation, they don't seem to want the advice. I find in Australia, I don't know what it's like in America, they don't want the advice of a 73-year-old for some reason. And there are plenty of opportunities where I've worked with a lot of much younger doctors and trainee specialists, and they somehow think they know it all.
Oh.
And don't realize what the senior person can offer in terms of a little bit of technique here, a little bit of advice there, and how do you cope with this problem? I find that commonplace, and so do other colleagues of mine, and I'm sure it's the same in America.
I think it is, and it's really a shame that there isn't the attention and given to an older, maybe retired person who has all this wisdom and experience. And you write in your foreword to the book, the object of these recommendations is to try to do things for women, not to women.
Yeah. So that's how it goes, and that's life, I guess. I'm reminded what my accountant taught me once. He said, when you're 17, you think you know more than your father.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you're 21, it's amazing how much your father has learned.
That's really true. So, so Jules, in preparing for this program, I went back into my files and I pulled out the notes that I took on August 12th, 1995 in Japan.
Wow, you still have them.
I do, you know, because in some ways I'm very organized.
Yeah.
And so here are the notes, and it was such, I still remember your presentation in Japan, and this was at a World Association for Sexology in Japan, 1995. And so I kind of like to just touch on some of these notes from Japan and get your reaction a little further, maybe updated, because the title of your talk was Medical and Gynecological Aspects of Sex Therapy.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And since we were in Japan, you made a very very cogent comment. And you said, in Japan, the attitude of many women is, my husband will teach me everything I need to know. Well, I also did some research in Japan in the early 90s, and what husbands knew wasn't very helpful in general, based on my interviews with Japanese wives. But I thought it was very good that you brought that in, because it's limited. But some women, I suppose, some women even in 2013 have that idea. I don't think as many do, but...
Yeah, but it's a cultural thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a cultural thing, Diana. You know how men have this sort of bravado, or just leave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a man, I know best, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a cover-up for very often a deep lack of knowledge about what they're talking about. It's just sheer boast.
Yeah. When I did my research in Japan about the Gai Geishas, which is a whole different population, but I did interview a number of wives who took advantage of this Gai Geisha population at this club IAI for Club Love.
Mm-hmm.
So often the women would say yes, they took part in going to the clubs and having these lovers, these professional, basically gigolos, right?
Yes.
Because their husbands were traveling a lot, and when they were home, they didn't pay very good attention to them. And then I heard from other women who said that the husbands would come home and say, bed, bath, you know, food bath bed.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't say much else. So talk about lack of emotional foreplay. They didn't have it.
So, you know, there's a very good example you give of women taking the initiative for their own sexuality.
Mm.
Now, that's all very well if you've got some knowledge and education behind you, but there's so many women, and that's where you and I come in as therapists, to help women find out what they would like, or what pushes their buttons, or to train the buttons to work in the first place. That's where therapy comes in.
Mm-hmm. And so then I'm going back to your talk in August of 95. Then you went on to Desperunia, and this, of course, is pain with intercourse. And you said at that time, when penetration hurts, there might be abrasions around the entrance.
Can
you update this on Desperunia?
I have a very pet quote on this very subject of painful intercourse.
Okay, good.
I wrote a chapter on this subject in a textbook once, and I've got a quote, and it says, "Patient, doctor, I don't enjoy sex because it hurts."
Uh-huh.
And the doctor's reply is, "Sex hurts because you don't enjoy it."
Right.
People get it the wrong way around.
Right.
And abrasions will occur, certainly, where a woman is ill-prepared and unaroused, so the very natural mechanism that God gave her, that's built in to her genitals, that will lubricate and open, ready to receive her partner. If they're not activated and that guy tries to stick that penis into this dry, unwelcoming opening, there will be abrasions.
Abrasions, and as I understand it too, that since the woman probably requires about 20 minutes of foreplay, if she has that, and I really want you to comment on this, Dr. Jules, if she has that, the entrance to her vagina thickens, the top part of her vagina tends out a little bit, and then the uterus above the cervix lifts up and away. And if that hasn't happened, then the penis during intercourse can hit the cervix and then the uterus, and that can cause some pain too. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you're not going to believe this. I know about two people in America. The other person, I think, is ringing on the other line, but I'm going to ignore it. Isn't it funny that both of you at the same time are ringing? So, look, it's absolutely correct. You're quoting correct physiology, correct anatomy.
Uh-huh.
And the uterus gets out of the way. It gets out of the firing line, as it were. And and then you get a vicious circle. If the woman anticipates pain and bang, the guy shoves it in, and it's therefore a self-fulfilling prophecy, it hurts. So the next time she's more fearful and it hurts even more.
Mm-hmm.
And she's downhill, and she then avoids sex and goes to bed late, hoping the husband's asleep by the time she gets into the bedroom. It's a whole bad scene, a string of vicious circles set in, and hopefully some of them end up with us, and we can straighten them out.
Yes, that's a big part of my work, to encourage couples to spend more time with foreplay and not just for the guy to just shove it in, as you put it.
It's a very colorful expression.
Yeah, I know. Okay, and then you actually, at the time in Japan, before we go back to the rest of your talk,
Yeah.
You said this was a proverb from 1640. God heals and the doctor takes the fee.
Exactly.
Would you like
That's
to expand
been one
on
of
that?
My big mantras. By the way, before we leave the subject of painful intercourse, or we may not be leaving it, it is in the mythology, it's out there in the culture, where a woman experiences this pain, she's told to use a lubricant.
Mm-hmm.
And that absolutely is the wrong advice if she has this kind of problem.
Why
and
is
I've
it the wrong
al-
advice,
said,
Jules?
That I've always said that the only place for lube in sex is on the outside bedroom doorknob.
Yeah, but serious, no, I agree. And I, of course, am always telling couples to, if they don't have a lock on their door, their master bedroom door, they must get one. Especially with little children, and then to train children that when mommy's and daddy's door is shut, that means you need to knock first, or if it's locked, to come back later. Older children can learn that lesson.
I mean, of course, there is a place here and there for lubricant in normal lovemaking, but as a total substitute for adequate arousal, that is totally wrong.
Right, it's wrong. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree. But for postmenopausal women, it can be essential. But we can return. We can return
that's
to
different,
that.
A different ball game, Diana.
Yeah. So back in Japan in 1995, you also talked about the need to teach masturbation, and I thought this is really important. You said, you know, you can rub three times a day, 20 minutes each. Most of the women I deal with won't do it for that long. They're busy and they don't want to do it. Even if they're anorgasmic. But you went on to say at that time, if women discover their sexuality, they become powerful. And there is probably a conspiracy, you said at the time, to keep women from getting familiar with their genitals and masturbation.
Yeah.
And that was especially true in Japan, but I think it's true, and it has been true in other cultures as well.
Oh, look, it's gone through history. You know, the church, for instance, had a very big investment in preventing women from discovering their own bodies, and many societies are the same. It's an age-old thing. And these barriers we need to break down. And very interesting, Diana, where I was in practice in Sydney, Australia, very close to me, a couple of suburbs away, was a very big Catholic seminary. And, of course, the Catholic Church, among many Orthodox religions. I don't have it in specifically for the Catholics, but there are many strict Orthodox religions. They had a seminary there, and it was a wonderful source of material.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've heard of the seven deadly sins. I'm sure you never committed any of them, Diana, but
I have.
Oh, you little sauce box. Anyway.
You know what, Jules? I like being a bit naughty.
Okay.
At least in my personal relationship.
Yes, but not while we're on the air, Diana. So,
I'm not going to say anything more than that.
No, you don't. Well, as regards to seven deadly sins, for the priests who run are attached to a church and they make confession and so on, there is a rule book for each sin. And the biggest rule book, as you can imagine, of the seven, relates to sex.
Oh, I'm sure. So say more about that, Jules.
Yeah, it's called the De Rebus Veneris ad confessoriorum about venal matters in the confessional. And it says in that book, it is lawful for the woman to stimulate her genitals in order that she may enjoy sex with her husband. Now, you see, it, admittedly, it only talks about the context of within marriage.
Uh-huh.
But there are so many priests to this day who either don't know that rule or know it but choose to keep the guilt thing going when it comes to masturbation.
Yeah.
And that's a big revelation, that it is all right to get in touch with your own body and prepare it and to, you know, bring up a level of arousal so that her sexual communion with her husband is fine. And we can argue, you and I, about married or not married. You and I, I'm sure, have the same opinion about that.
Mm-hmm.
But for many married Catholic women who have had this guilt all these years, it's wonderful to be able to quote that, and I got a printout of that part of the confessional rules.
Very good.
People are frightened of masturbation.
Yes, and you said in Japan, and so this is 1995, and I've come to know this clinically and personally, frankly, that women who discover their sexuality become more powerful. And there is a conspiracy, you said, to keep women from getting familiar with their genitals and masturbating. And
yes,
when I was at UCLA in the Female Sexual Medicine Center, I saw that time and time again. And speaking, going back to your Catholics, I had a Catholic adult woman who still was not reaching orgasm except by lying on her stomach on a carpet and rocking, because...
Lying on a what, Diana?
On her stomach and rocking.
Oh, yes, yes,
on
yes.
The carpet.
On the carpet, yes.
Because she wasn't touching down there.
Oh.
And, you know, the Catholic Church said, you can't touch down there. So she wasn't, look, ma, no hands, she wasn't touching. But
yes.
But this method of her reaching orgasm, of course, is not exactly partner compatible, is it?
Well, I was going to say, that kind of woman, and I've seen a lot of them,
yeah,
the only way they can reach any kind of pleasure with their partners if he's lying down representing the carpet and she rocks up and down on his pubes. And as a man, I can tell you, Diana, that kills. And all,
yes,
all romance fades. Because, you know, pubic hair is a bit like steel wool. And the poor guys, you know. But when I would hear about that story about how the woman could reach arousal, that would give me very big clues,
mm-hmm,
in therapy how to teach her to climax in a manner and in a position compatible with a partner. And by behavior modification techniques, that kind of woman can very readily then climax with a partner.
So, Jules, we're coming up on a couple-minute break, and I wanted to let the listening audience know, and, of course, many will archive this, will listen to this program in the archived version, which is great. But when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about deep dyspareunia and positions that, this is all from your notes, I mean from my notes, based on your talk in Japan. So positions that help with this. And then we're also going to talk about the G-spot, hysterectomies, and then also sex and pregnancy, because as a retired OBGYN, but how long did you practice?
30 years.
30 years. So You know a lot about sexuality and pregnancy, so we're going to talk about that too. So stay with us, and we'll be back soon. Thank you. Diana Wiley, Dr. Diana Wiley, back with you with Dr. Jules Black, an MD and a sex educator, internationally renowned. I'm just thrilled that Jules is on this program today. And I was going back to a lecture he gave in Japan in August of 1995. And this will be a lead-in to sexuality and pregnancy, which you know a lot about, Dr. Jules. You said in Japan, and I thought this was fascinating, and I even thought about my own daughter who gave birth a year ago to her second son, and you've met my daughter because she was at our World Congress in Paris in 2001.
I remember her well.
Yes. And I've written to her. She's in Victoria, B.C., and encouraged her to listen if she can. So, but you said in that lecture, in pregnancy, if a woman carries a boy, her testosterone can be up. It peaks at 18 weeks. And so there's more acne and greasy hair and high sex drive. High sex. And, you know, I looked at those notes, and I'd forgotten that, but I remember my daughter complaining about her acne, and it's because she was carrying a boy, and I'd forgotten about that.
You see, the old expression in pregnancy is that a woman has a peaches and cream complexion.
Yes.
But here you find these poor things at 18 weeks, and their faces are falling off with acne, and they can't understand. And their pubic hair grows like alfalfa sprouts over the top of their undies.
Yeah.
And some of them have a heightened sexuality. They're so embarrassed, they can't talk about it. I used to have a thing with my patients about predicting the baby sex on this basis, round about the halfway mark. And they said, what do you think I'm carrying, doctor? I said, well, look, I will tell you my prediction, but around halfway through the pregnancy, and I don't want to give anything away. And I would ask the questions about their complexion and their underarm hair, pubic hair and so on, and then about their sex drive. Well, it turns out I had a couple of deliveries, and I had predicted a girl on the basis of their answers, and out had come a boy each time. And I'd say, oh, I was wrong. But the husbands would pull me aside and they'd say, Jules, you were actually right. My wife came home from that visit and told me the questions you asked her, but she was too embarrassed to say anything. Never in our married lives before. She's been waking me up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning doing numbers on me.
Because of the high testosterone levels and high desire.
And they'd be too embarrassed to tell the correct story. There you go. So
well,
very real.
Yes, and you also talk about women sometimes. So this is not from Japan in the notes, but being women, because we need so many women have really poor body image, and how women in pregnancy can be more forgiving of their body's imperfections and more focused on the pleasure their bodies give them during pregnancy, because all the hormones are up and they might have more intense orgasms and all of that.
Yes, and don't forget cortisone levels are also up. And that causes a euphoria. You know, they really feel good. And I'll tell you something else, Diana.
Yes.
Women give birth the way they make love.
Yes, that's in your book, and that was fascinating to me, especially since with my first child was about 3 hours of labor. My second child was 7 minutes. He came after I got to the hospital. And I was very glad to read that.
Yeah, if you'd have had a third baby and I was looking after you with that history, at the first visit I would have given you a shaving mirror and a butterfly net so you could do it all yourself, because there'd be no time to get to the hospital.
Yes, well, so there is a connection then, perhaps. Or but not that perhaps, between
that's how that woman's
easily
body
orgasmic
works.
Women and their abilities to give birth or have a shorter labor. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. If they have strong orgasms, that's what their uterus does. And so when they come into labor, that uterus doesn't mess about. It contracts. It contracts strongly and pushes that baby out in no time at all.
Yeah.
And I was at a very elegant luncheon one year at the New York Yachting Club, a very elegant lunch, and sitting next to me was an Australian model. She was very highly prized in Paris, you know, the long legs and the catwalks and so on. She was known internationally, and I'm having my lunch quietly, and she said, "Oh, I believe you're an OBGYN." And I said, "Yes." She said, "I've had a couple of babies." You know how the conversation goes. I said, "Oh, that's nice." And she said, "Yes, I had my first baby in an hour and a half, and he weighed 9 pounds 6. And I said,
"Big baby."
"Well, that tells me a lot about you." And I kept on eating. And she said, "What does it tell you about me?" And I said, "It tells me that you have very strong orgasms and that that's what your uterus does. And that's why you had an exceptionally rapid labor first time round and with such a big baby." And she pondered on this and she said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do." And I said, "Lucky you." And I continued with my lunch.
She probably wanted to ask you more questions, though.
Yeah, but I wanted to have my lunch.
Well, you know, until I read that in your book, I had not made that association before. And, of course, I've worked with, over the 30-plus years I've been in my profession as a sex therapist, I've worked with many, many women who are anorgasmic, pre-orgasmic, and you know Maria Flaherty, she and I co-led two women's sexuality groups together for 11 years, and all of these women have had sexual abuse, sexual trauma in their past. So there's a way to relearn and to get back in touch with your body, because so many of these women disassociate because of the sexual trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very sad in our society, isn't it?
And, yeah.
It's very real, and you see a lot of it. I when I was in practice, I saw quite a bit of it. It's very sad.
Well, it is very sad, and these people who have men too, of course, and women who've experienced sexual abuse, molestation, trauma of any sort, almost always need to see a professional sex therapist, somebody who has experience in working with these problems, because it's very difficult to get past this without professional help, don't you think, Jules?
Absolutely. And the big message for your listeners, Diana, is that with the therapy, the success rate is very high. It's something like 83%. I mean, unfortunately, there's this hardcore of about 17% of women who've been so traumatized, who really don't want to, they don't want to know, they don't want to be better. But for 83%, there's a very bright future with therapy.
Well, it is, and I've seen many women improve, and of course and I've had a few men who've had sexual trauma, not as many as I've had women, but and with men there's often a little more shame attached because a lot of times the perpetrator was another man.
Yes.
And so then they say, oh, I brought it on myself, and maybe I'm gay, and there's all this
very real.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's part of the satisfaction of my work, and I'm sure yours too, is to see patients, clients, get help and get better.
Yes, yes.
Normal, we don't like to use the word normal, but close to more normal responses to sexuality and
absolutely.
And enjoy the true pleasure.
Yeah, you've just triggered me, Diana. Do you find, unfortunately, with Cialis and with Viagra and so on, that men, and the doctors are actually pushing these pills as well,
mm-hmm.
to short-circuit the need for therapy, and the guys aren't having their prescriptions refilled because it's really not working either. You have to overcome these attitudes, these traumas you may have had, and a pill won't do it for you.
Exactly. A pill won't do it, and that's why when Viagra was first approved in the United States, FDA approved in April of 98, and then what followed were a lot of so-called Viagra divorces.
Mm.
And that's because the guys now could get an erection, but they hadn't been paying attention to the relationship. And their wives would look at them in dismay and say, you want to have intercourse? You have not been paying attention to me. Why would I want to have intercourse with you?
Mm. Yeah.
And then he would leave thinking, oh, well, now I can get it up. I can go fuck another woman.
Yes.
I can say that because it's, it's internet radio.
Yes, it's so you have the same thing over here, and
I'm sure you did in Australia.
Hmm. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the relationship. Women are concerned more with the relationship. And they're much more likely to be sexual if they feel desire.
Yeah.
Desire from their partner. And then they can feel desire.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah.
Very true. And it's our bread and butter, Diana.
It's what? Say again?
Our bread and butter.
Oh, bread and butter, yes.
Yes.
So you had some interesting things to say about Michael Douglas's comment about oral sex and HPV and in your book, Body Talk, you talk about thrush and the connection. So could you talk a little bit about that?
I'd be very happy to. Maybe your listeners, if you don't mind, I'll just recap. It was only in the last month, I think, that Michael Douglas, no, it was more than that because I've been in America for a month. In the last 2 months, we all know that Michael Douglas was afflicted by some kind of throat cancer. Thank goodness it sounds like all is well. And he's made that film I can't wait to see about Liberace.
Yeah,
can't wait
that would
to see
be
it.
That'll be fun.
Yes, and he came out in the press and confessed that the particular form of oral or throat cancer that he had was, and we can prove this now with DNA testing very easily, due to wart virus. And it is now HPV, or human papillomavirus, or wart virus, that causes cancer of the cervix in women, abnormal pap smears, genital warts in men and women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for years, I led a campaign in Australia about the problems that oral sex can cause with catching a thrush or yeast infection or venereal, whatever you want to call it. These are terribly common infections that women can get with antibiotics or whatever the case can be. And the contact between a woman's genitals and a man's mouth or a man's penis and a woman's mouth, and particularly if a man is uncircumcised, he can harbour this fungus, this yeast, under his foreskin. And we kind of call it ping-pong disease. Then you treat one of the couple.
Ping-pong.
Yeah, because then that person is fixed up, and then they have sex again, but they get it back from the partner, and it just goes backwards and forth like a ping-pong ball.
Back and forth.
But people have trouble, and doctors have trouble, thinking about this. Many of them don't know about it, and why patients keep coming back with recurrent thrush, because they haven't thought about the cause. So now here we have Michael Douglas coming along, and those of us in the know have known for quite a while that a lot of cases of oral cancer, now that's the tongue, that's the tonsils, that's the palate, and then there's the throat and the larynx and even lung cancer. Diana, some of the lung cancers, we can find it's due to HPV. And
even lung
where
cancer.
Did they get the wart virus, but from their partners.
Okay, and, so what do you recommend to people that are, perhaps they've been tested for AIDS and so on, but they're with a partner and they're enjoying oral sex? What do you recommend?
Well, the first thing I have to say is to be as one-to-one as possible. These kind of problems occur where a person has multiple partners. And if they are multiple partners, people usually a bit indiscriminate. And when AIDS first started, you and I will remember, women were warned that, you know, if you have sex with a man, you're actually having sex with the last three or four women that he had sex with,
and so
it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be tested. But we now have this wonderful vaccine, this HPV vaccine,
which
has been tried and tested and is a big success story. It's already dramatically and measurably cutting down the incidence of abnormal pap smears, genital warts in men and women. And because men should be getting this vaccine as well, and it's cutting down, and we think it's going to cut down these forms of oral and lung cancers, and people are worried about this vaccine. It's going to lead to promiscuity. If we give it to our teenage daughters, they will then think this is a license to go out and screw around. If a girl is going to go and screw around, she's going to screw around with or without this vaccine. And Diana, I'm in Las Vegas at the moment, and last Friday I caught Jay Leno was here doing his stand-up routine.
Yes.
And he was talking about there are sort of teenage undies for girls, and they have rather sexually explicit sayings printed on them, you know, love
printed
me tonight,
on them. Mm-hmm.
Or I'll love you always.
Mm-hmm.
And people are up in arms saying, oh, that's going to lead to promiscuity, wearing knickers like that. And he said, if a guy is close enough to be able to read what she's got in her on her knickers, she's already in big trouble. And it's got nothing to do with it. Yeah, and it's just like, you know, the rubella vaccine, the German measles vaccine, which we, have given to our schoolgirl daughters for years.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that hopefully this is before they become sexually active. So if they happen to get German measles, to prevent them getting German measles when they're pregnant, so the baby won't be blind or mentally deficient or have a heart abnormality or even have a dead baby.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very comfortable with that. But it's the same principle. It's like, that didn't lead to promiscuity of girls because they had the rubella vaccine. Likewise here with the wart virus vaccine. I recommend it to all your listeners that they get their daughters vaccinated. It's not going to make them promiscuous, but it will protect them from the wart virus. And it's very serious effects sometimes. When they do become sexually active one day, and Michael Douglas, I think, has made has given a great service to the community by fessing up and making people aware of orogenital contact, as we call it. There are diseases that are spread, and that doesn't mean you shouldn't have orogenital contact, but you should be rather discerning with whom you have orogenital contact with.
So I agree, but can you get this vaccine as an adult, and will it help?
Oh, look, yes, you can, and it costs, where I come from, and I think in some American states, if not universally, there are programs afoot where school kids can get it for free certain communities and,
uh-huh.
and so on.
Yeah.
And one should avail oneself of that service because it's one of the real success stories in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of early rumors that it caused various other problems, but it doesn't, and it's in the medical literature already. Very many positive papers about the very good effects of vaccinating. So that's a message I'd like to put out there on your program.
Well, you have done it, and you've also put out many other messages that are absolutely useful. And I'm now reading from the introduction, the foreword that a friend of a colleague, I guess, of Dr. Jules Black wrote, and she said, I'm reading now from the foreword, "It was Jules Black who first explained to me that the word obstetrics comes from the Latin word meaning to stand before. That is how he sees his role, as an observer helping women to birth rather than delivering their babies for them." That's an important distinction, I never knew what obstetrics meant, you know.
I've always felt very privileged to be there at that magic moment of birth.
Oh, it must be something. Talk a little bit more about that. We have to stop a couple of minutes before the top of the hour, delivering a baby.
Yeah, I can do that very quickly. The two most powerful sorts of births that I was privileged to attend
mm-hmm.
is where you have the mother present, the woman giving birth present, and I deliver a girl. Suddenly, instantly, you have three generations of women. That's very powerful.
Mm.
And the other one is where the patient, the woman giving birth, was in fact adopted. And her adoptive mother is present, who could never give birth, but she'd been there to experience childbirth.
Mm.
Very powerful.
And you said, I'm going back to the Japanese, the notes that I took in Japan. When you delivered a baby, and if you see the clitoris standing up like a soldier,
yep.
That was good. And then you said that sometimes a midwife may stimulate the clit.
Yes.
And maybe that's for an orgasm to help with, I'm thinking, the contractions to get that baby out?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Some women actually orgasm at the moment of birth. After the head is coming down, it's putting pressure on the back wall of the vagina, which is against the rectum. And there's a reflex that Dr. Ferguson in the 1940s in Great Britain talked about, the Ferguson reflex. Pressing on the low rectum by the head suddenly releases a burst of oxytocin, the hormone that makes the uterus contract either in childbirth or in orgasm, and bang, they get these massive contractions, and out comes the baby, and the clitoris is standing up like a soldier. Water is gushing out, you see, just like vaginal lubrication with arousal. Sheila Kitzinger, who's one of the world's great natural childbirth people, she talks about that in her book about this very phenomenon. Now, I'm not sure who should stimulate. I would never do it. There is the odd home birth midwife in Australia who does it. I think the partner is very busy up the other end, mopping the fevered brow and whispering sweet nothings. But
Jules,
there is the clitoris sometimes.
We have to
stop.
And I have so appreciated this time with you, and I know our listeners have as well. And you are a doctor who does things for women, not to women. And so you've been especially wonderful.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, Diana. Lovely to talk to you after an interval of years.
Thank you.
And I hope it's not so long next time.
Exactly. I hope so, too.
Right.
Goodbye. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye, Diana.
And thank you, Jules, especially.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I love